morning. My name is Michael McCusker. 50 years ago today, on January 14, 1966, I boarded a U.S. Navy troop ship in Long Beach, California, with about 500 other Marines bound for Vietnam, quite a few of whom returned home in body bags or bandages. 2 months later, after a wild three-week "We Who Are About to Die" debauchery in Okinawa, a second ship, named after a signer of the Declaration of Independence, but notoriously known as the Greasy George, hauled us down south to Chulai, South Vietnam. I spent the rest of that year, 1966, and part of 1967, as a USMC reporter-photographer, combat correspondent, with Marine infantry and reconnaissance up around the 17th parallel demilitarized zone that separated South Vietnam from the North. No Purple Hearts for wounds, no medals for valor. I was honorably discharged, but I did not receive a good conduct medal. Half a century later, the war is never far from my thoughts, essentially an underlying music scored for horror movies, which I expect to last until I finish up on the other side of the dirt with my war mates who did not survive Vietnam or died later from wounds, drugs, suicide, or just plain numbed inertia. Well-meaning friends insist I forget about the war, but that is as impossible as it is dishonest to deny war's insights into the real human character we generally camouflage to protect ourselves from self-knowledge. Although returning Vietnam veterans were shunned as baby killers, an unforgiving phrase few of us have forgiven, it is now commonplace cliche for war veterans to be thanked for our service. I usually reply that gratitude for attempted genocide against Vietnamese is misplaced. The acronym for winning hearts and minds is WHAM, like the bursting of a bomb or shell. I will go to my grave with profound remorse about my part in the deaths of many hundreds of Vietnamese. I saw entire villages decimated by artillery and bombs, napalm in particular, and by those of us on the ground in search and destroy annihilations through countless village hamlets. We were anachronisms, infantry in the nuclear age, and though we killed with modern weapons, we warred no differently than the ancients who hurled spears. We were parts of a machine, each of us reduced to a specific function in a common mush, hammered and smashed around like a piece of rock until it takes the shape of a weapon. It seemed as if we had done nothing else in our lives but kill and try not to be killed, under a hot sun or in mud and rain. We attacked and smashed small villages with rifles, artillery, and bombs. We fought through wildly violent ambushes and were constantly plagued by snipers, landmines, and booby traps. We exacted savage revenge for every death or wound. We murdered the vulnerable because we seldom could find or identify the phantoms who shot at us or blew our bodies apart. In the villages, we beat poor peasants or allowed our Vietnamese allies to torture them. We tied old men and boys, sometimes women and girls, to trees and set our dogs at them. We attached electrical wires to their genitals or nostrils and cranked the switches. We threw them out of helicopters. We were murderous armed children who sympathized with nothing except our chances for survival. We wished for nothing more than to leave Vietnam, although it has never left us. Everything that happened to us there seemed beyond reason or moral speculation. A garish kaleidoscope of terrible sounds and bleeding flesh, bound by distant voices on military radios and by helicopters that flew food, ammunition, and replacements in exchange for the wounded and dead they removed like disposable rubbish. Artillery rounds and jet bombers shrieked over our heads and annihilated villages, paddies, and jungles, and left us alone with torn, burnt bodies of humans and animals strewn in fields or among the ruins of mud and straw-thatched homes. Helicopters carried us like deadly viruses to remote mountains and valleys whose only contact with Western civilization were the bombs and napalm dropped by the jets that preceded us. We hacked through jungles, walked through oceans of wet rice fields, crawled and ran toward burning villages, shooting rifles and machine guns at everyone in them. Everywhere we went, we destroyed almost everything. We had come several thousand miles, several hundred thousand of us, generally ignorant of why we should. Officers with charts and pointers explained that the future of Western civilization demanded our presence in Vietnam. Here, we would stop godless communism and reverse the domino theory. We fought because the Vietnamese asked for our help, the officers said, then contradicted themselves by warning that we would surely lose our lives or limbs by trusting a single Vietnamese. Old grandmothers planted mines and booby traps. Children sold soft drinks filled with shards of broken glass and blew themselves up with explosives in crowds of American soldiers. Young women were whores and artfully concealed razor blades in their vaginas. Farmers and their sons and daughters were enemy Viet Cong guerrillas at night. We in the lesser ranks understood the riddle, but most of us did not care. It was implicit that even the lowliest of us represented a superior civilization, as had the French who were there before us. Our attitude toward the Vietnamese was that they were inferior to us. Finally, back home, I was tormented by what I experienced in Vietnam. At some point in the war, I was unable to accept the brutal racism, the fear and loathing of Americans toward Vietnamese. I had never seen a people so determined to survive with so little to recommend it. They fought relentlessly against foreign invaders, and no matter how well we deceived ourselves about the war, the Vietnamese were not deceived. Though I never accepted their cause, I learned to respect the uncompromising manner in which they fought for it. The indiscriminate war we fought against them made their ultimate success inevitable. We learned from history that we learn nothing from it, George Bernard Shaw et al. Said. Vietnam was a cynical war of attrition designed by men who knew little of history but thought they could impose their will upon it simply because it was their will to do so. The United States replaced the French in Vietnam in exactly the same manner that led to their defeat, but our arrogance was that we were Americans and we confidently committed the same errors as if we could reverse them by the force of who we were. We raised Vietnamese culture and slaughtered its people as if it was our historical prerogative. We imposed a hated government and enforced its authority with our bombers and battalions. We dropped perhaps as many bombs in Vietnam as during all of World War II and poisoned its population with herbicides sprayed from the sky. We invented the body count as an index and declared every peasant we killed an enemy, which was proved by their deaths. We removed hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese from their ancestral homes and villages to prevent them from assisting the guerrillas we were never able to destroy, and abandoned them to filthy, overcrowded refugee camps, or to beg and starve, or whore in the cities. We hired death squads to liquidate political opposition and participated in the opium trade to pay mercenaries. At one point, although the killing did not stop, the Vietnam War was officially declared over. The last American soldiers came home. One wrote on a wall at Saigon's Tan Sanh Airport, "Will the last American to leave please turn out the light at the end of the tunnel?" There was never a light, only a long, dark tunnel into which millions disappeared, among them almost 60,000 dead Americans. Of the 500,000 American wounded, thousands returned home without legs, arms, or genitals. Thousands more were paralyzed physically or psychologically. The wounded overflowed U.S. military hospitals in Asia and Europe, the most critically injured eventually to stateside hospitals near their home cities, if possible. But more likely, they wound up in VA hospitals too poorly funded and understaffed to adequately care for them. The dead were also returned and invisibly crossed the country in railroad mail cars or jetliner baggage compartments. Five presidents tried to keep the Vietnam War from upsetting the citizenry. They promised guns and butter while sacrificing the nation's sons and money. Night after night, the public was numbed to the war by the artifice of television news. Vietnam was the first television war. Yet few ever saw any of the American dead. the mention or sight of dead or wounded GIs was considered bad for morale. American deaths were edited out of the war. At the same time, the war's measure of success was a grossly exaggerated body count of enemy dead. After the euphoria of the initial massive buildup of U.S. troops in 1965, after Operation Starlight and the Ia Drang Valley, after Tet 68 and Khe Sanh, after Wei and My Lai, after Nixon sent the army into Cambodia and it returned with heroin, the American public became dismayed with its soldier sons and daughters. Something solid was expected of soldiers, but the Vietnam generation was beginning to change. And into what? The soldiers wore peace medallions into combat, smoked marijuana, also opium and heroin, killed their superiors and sabotaged weapons and equipment, and rebelled against the military by the thousands. No one but the soldiers understood the rebellion was a desperate yet rational response to the war and inequities of the military system and its callous disregard for the lives of its lower ranks. The ratio of approximately 14 non-combatants to one combat man, the racial tensions that threatened to engulf every military installation at home in Europe and Asia, the draft that provided escape for the upper classes, but hardly any for the poor or non-white, were some of the factors that heightened dissatisfaction in the ranks. But it was the intensifying doubts about the purpose of the war itself that were the most unsettling. For many soldiers, perhaps most, there was no other fight in the war other than self-preservation, mixed with grim awareness they were being badly used. They were brutal, murderous, and insensitive. They were also terrified, anguished, and spiritually desolate. On April 30th, 1975, the Vietnam War finally ended, 10 years after American Marines landed in Da Nang, and 3 years after most American forces had been withdrawn, except Marines who helped evacuate the last Americans and Vietnamese cohorts. First in, last out. The North Vietnamese Army marched into Saigon on that last day of April and renamed it Ho Chi Minh City after Vietnam's George Washington, who died 6 years earlier. For them, 3 decades of bitter civil war were over. They had also fought and defeated 2 Western powers that attempted to subjugate them. The United States spent a generation attempting to dominate Southeast Asia, yet the war was lost long before it committed its armies. We knew little and cared less for the cultures and peoples that lived there, and our genocidal hubris ultimately caused our defeat. We failed in our attempt to impose the rules of chess in the land of Go. The loss of the war in Vietnam shocked the people of the United States. It might have been different if the war had been won. The people might not have been so ashamed or divided. Victory is its own therapeutic morality. If the war had been won, the cause would naturally have been considered just. The men who designed the war blamed its loss on the men and women who survived it. We were made its scapegoats and shunned as lepers and losers. Our friends and families were ashamed of us. We had been the nation's agents in a dirty, unpopular, and unsuccessful war, and were as a result treated as if we were also dirt. We were expected to pick up our lives as if we had not changed in the pitiless crucible of combat. War pared us to the raw edge of perception, but we were implored to reaccept our culture's illusions and vanities and conform to a perspective of history our experience repudiated. We were pariahs not entirely because we rankled the public memory. The war left us with irreversible knowledge about ourselves that people usually wish to avoid. We learned that only human beings commit inhuman acts and that the most cherished inhumane values serve as war cries to commit horror. We learned that the concepts about the worth of life are worthless as arguments to preserve it. We discovered it is absurdly easy to kill and that it is common to feel relief and satisfaction at the anguish of someone else. We learned how to reduce flesh and blood to abstract contempt to facilitate our reduction of it to dust. The price of survival has been high. Many disorders, which are still evident decades afterward, had their origin in the terror directed at us and the terror we repaid it with. The saddest irony is that so many who fought like beasts to live through the war have suicided since returning home. The poisons we sprayed upon the Vietnamese have been killing us, although the government stonewalls the claims of veterans that they are sick or dying from the chemicals. Jails were for a long time filled with Vietnam veterans. Homeless Vietnam vets are a national cliche. We are alcoholics and heavy drug users. We are unpredictably violent. All sorts of syndromes have been attributed to us or invented to describe us. Studies have been routinely commissioned to define or find solutions to our social depravity. We formed rap groups to assist each other, but these often serve to intensify our maladjustment or alienation. The nightmares that seldom leave us even so many years later, exacerbated by more recent wars, retain an incompleteness that reflects our fragmented experience in the war. For most of the decade of massive escalation, hundreds of thousands of us went to war and returned daily almost without notice. We passed each other going and coming to and from Vietnam. The war never entirely slides out of my thoughts. Sometimes it lies quietly on the far side of my mind like a sleeping dog, but eventually something triggers its loop to the closer circuit, and nearly everything I do, see, or think about has its basis or parallel rooted in Vietnam. I spent only a year in Vietnam, but it shines through the murk of subsequent years with a clarity missing from the rest. To survive, I cut off sensitivities I believe are irrecoverably lost. I continue to feel that every day is extra, and I will never comprehend why or adequately use to justify. I believe I was measurably responsible for the deaths of Vietnamese whose lives were palpably worth more than my own, and that friends who died would have been more useful alive than I am. I remain haunted by the dead. Everyone who has endured combat is drawn ever afterward toward death, grimly aware that escape is only temporary. Dead friends vex survivors with sorrow and guilt and beckon for us to rejoin their company. On the day the war ended, I telephoned a friend who had shared our small part of it 9 years earlier. The war had been over for us for a long time, yet he was angry and bitter. The wrong side had won the war, and its victory made a mockery of the deaths of 58,000 Americans, he said. A few of them had been our friends. I argued that millions more Southeast Asians had been killed, and that finally, after a generation of incessant war, the survivors could get on with their histories in relative peace without interference. I did not anticipate the boat people from Vietnam, the wars with China, or the murders of two-thirds of the people of Cambodia by its new leaders. My friend and I were only briefly involved, a single-year tour in Vietnam. We thought our experience there would bind us for life, but our separate opinions made us adversaries instead. He supported the war. I was against it. He thought that I betrayed the men we fought alongside, especially those who died or were crippled from wounds. I thought nobody else should be killed, which meant actively protesting the war to end it. Many Vietnam veterans will never agree the war was a pointless and egregious loss of life. But a significant number of others do, in particular the soul-stricken soldiers and Marines who want the unpleasant truths of the war known. It is a debate that involves our entire generation and won't end, at least among us, until we are all dead. Vietnam removed my trust in governmental ethics, and I learned to regard patriotism as a narrow and cynical appeal for prejudice, injustice, and murder. I turned irrevocably against the Vietnam War, but even my stance for peace was grim and warlike, and my experience against the war was for the most part violent, although I was generally on the receiving end of the violence perpetrated by police and National Guard units, which seemed a form of retribution for my part in Vietnam. I got beat up by cops, maced, tear-gassed, and arrested all around the country, organizing anti-war veterans and participating in anti-war demonstrations. I became an early member of Vietnam Veterans Against the War. I threw my war medals at the Capitol Building in Washington, D.C. in April 1971 with 1,000 other Vietnam veterans, and a week later was one of 20 vets who dumped large amounts of fresh chicken scat on the front steps of the Pentagon. We might have used explosives instead of a substance, one of us, when arrested, said was foul defecation distribution. our message was that Frankenstein's monster was bringing the war home. The unequivocal purpose of VVAW was to end the Vietnam War and redeploy U.S. troops from Southeast Asia. To that end, we held two war crimes testimonies in response to the slaughter of Vietnamese civilians in My Lai Village in 1968. These winter soldier, in contrast to sunshine patriots, forums were held in Washington, D.C. and Detroit, Michigan. The body count of Vietnam vets who took part was nearly 200, though few heard what we said because of a press blackout. It was the first time most of us publicly related our experiences in Vietnam, and the first opportunity to listen to the experiences of other vets, which were virtually identical over a decade of war. The most important factor was a redundancy, revealing a pattern of deja vu atrocities in countless unnoted My Lais, linked by men whose service in Vietnam spanned the period of American intervention. For the first time, we were able to collectively piece together our individual roles in the war like parts of a puzzle that implied a deliberate policy of cultural genocide by the highest levels of the U.S. government. At first, I believed people would listen to those of us who fought the war rather than the fraudulent propaganda by deceitful war hawks responsible for it. I was wrong. We were denounced as traitors instead, even as cowards, which underscored a deep misunderstanding and animosity between those who experience war and those who have not. I was at the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C. when it was dedicated on Veterans Day in 1982. The wall of names of Americans killed in Vietnam is what a war memorial ought to be, a measure of its cost. But at the time, it was incomplete for what I thought were pretty petty reasons. Names were missing, those who died later of wounds, and no women. Thousands of Vietnam vets, women and men, crowded into D.C. from all over the USA for the dedication, hoping to be finally acknowledged after years of neglect and disparagement for enduring not only the war, but absorbing the nation's guilt for it. I was there to look for names of a few dead friends I last saw wrapped in bloody ponchos and tossed aboard medevac helicopters. I felt disconnected, much the same as if I were at a school or scout troop reunion. I had forgotten names I thought I would always remember. I felt smothered by flags and military bands and thought the ceremony had little to do with reconciliation, but was staged instead to revive a war fever Vietnam had cooled. Yet our presence must have been an intense embarrassment, a tattered and crippled specter of a lost war. Names of the dead occupied the black marble wall of the Vietnam Memorial chronologically by the days of their deaths, arranged in daily sequence in alphabetical order so that they will forever remain together, sculptor Maya Lin said. I ran my fingers in the carved grooves of the names I did remember. They had been dead a long time by then, and I felt slightly indifferent. I realized memorial will never be complete until a separate wall with the names of Viet Cong and North Vietnamese soldiers killed in the war is built alongside, and that both walls are encircled by an immense shrine listing the names of the millions of ordinary Vietnamese, also Cambodians and Laotians, who died because they were the water the killer fish swam in, to paraphrase Mao Zedong's famous metaphor that the people were the sea to be fought over. I thought a special monument naming the murdered dead of My Lai by Americans and Way by North Vietnamese would serve as a warning that the real enemy is the malevolence we humans display toward each other. Nearly unnoticed against the Vietnam wall among flowers, war medals, and photographs of young soldiers, sailors, pilots, and Marines was a hand-lettered square of cardboard with the names of four war dead who had not been nor are yet included. They were killed in early May 1970, just after American troops invaded Cambodia. The four students shot down by the Ohio National Guard at Kent State College. I left D.C. with friends from Oregon. We drove through Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Nebraska, Wyoming, Utah, Idaho, and Oregon, reaching home in Cannon Beach on the North Oregon coast 5 days later. We stopped every night at motels or the homes of friends or relatives, and each day we made several stops for food, gas, bathrooms, and to just get out and stretch. On the back window of our small truck was a Vietnam Veterans of America sticker, the group that built and dedicated the Vietnam War Memorial. Everywhere we stopped, people noticed the sticker, and almost everyone was related to or knew someone killed in Vietnam. Everywhere we stopped, I opened a book I purchased at the memorial. It was the size of a small city's phone directory and contained the names engraved on the wall, nearly 60,000, and where each was located. I looked up names people wished to see, and many touched the letters in the book, as so many have embraced the names on the wall with their fingers. By the time we reached the Pacific Coast, the American Book of the Dead, as I called it, was as well thumbed as a phone book in a public booth. Until then, I had not really understood the personal impact of Vietnam on America's heart. Each time I opened the book and looked for a name, I felt I was performing a ritual of immense, unrecognized grief. Perhaps the most enduring lesson of the Vietnam War, and a major reason the government would wish to suppress it from public memory or attention, is that a significant number of Americans were against it. When they were rebuffed by the government, they went out into the streets and risked injury and arrest. Thousands of young men chose exile or jail over service in Vietnam. Other thousands who were in the military rebelled against it. Although a reconstructed myth portrays dissenters as irresponsible students, antisocial hippies, and various other types of misfits and malcontents, the largest number of anti-war activists were from the mainstream. And in the spring of 1971, the mainstream peaked when 500,000 of them, the official body count of U.S. forces in Vietnam at the height of the war's escalation, marched through the streets of Washington, D.C. to demand an end to the war. Seldom mentioned and usually disparaged when it is, the American people ultimately forced its government to abandon its discredited ambitions in Southeast Asia. It is that which disturbs our leaders most and which they would have us forget, that we can and must, if necessary, curb our government's misuse of power. Underneath the spectacle of pageantry and deceit of patriotism, the disturbing presence of Vietnam veterans demonstrates with the subtlety of a clenched fist that war is death and horror. It is murder and depravity and sickens the souls and minds of its executioners. Vietnam veterans give war a bad name. And that was Old Wars Never Die. I should give a disclaimer that what you have just heard is my opinion and perhaps my opinion only, although there might be corroborative echoes from every battleground, from every war, everywhere in the cosmos, from every time. And a little bit of a postscript. 30 years ago, in 1986, I met a retired Marine Corps general who was visiting Astoria. He said the French had prepared three critiques of why they lost their war to recolonize Vietnam, militarily, politically, and economically. He said the reports were impressively honest and self-critical. He had asked Army General Paul Harkins, Westmoreland's predecessor in Saigon, if he had read the reports. Harkins said he had not because he didn't understand French. That was the quality of our military leadership in Vietnam, the retired Marine General said. I would like to end this program with a poem by Brian Alec Floyd, who was a Marine in Vietnam. Our village. This is what the war ended up being about. We would find a VC village, and if we could not capture it or clear it of Kong, we called for jets. The jets would come in low and terrible, sweeping down and screaming in their first pass over the village. Then they would return, dropping their first bombs that flattened the huts to rubble and debris, to dust and ashes. And then the jets would come back once again in a last pass, this time to drop napalm that burned the dust and ashes to just nothing. Then the village that was not a village anymore was our village. And that was Brian Alec Floyd from a manuscript of Vietnam poems he wrote and left mimeographed copies of in the Portland VA Center several years ago. The poems are all that anybody seems to know about him. A friend sent me a copy of them, and I printed several in my newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle, and I might eventually attempt to publish them as a book. This has been Michael McCusker.